TheYeshiva.net.
There's a famous statement in the Talmud, in Tractate Tainus, Maseches Tainus, page 29, that Kol HaMisabel al Yerushalayim Zoyche V'roye B'Simchasa. Whoever mourns for Jerusalem merits and sees its joy. By the way, the crowd that's sitting here is part of the crowd. There's a large crowd that's watching us live virtually from different types of backgrounds and walks of life. Hence, I try to translate everything into English. Those who don't, who understand the original, shouldn't feel insulted that I'm, God forbid, underestimating your intelligence or your scholastic genius and knowledge. It's simply that everybody who's listening from across the world should be able to hopefully understand it and get it. The words of our sages of the Chazal are always precise. Whoever mourns for Jerusalem merits and sees his joy seems grammatically off. One would expect the rabbis to say, whoever mourns for Jerusalem will merit and see its joy in the future. Obviously, when we are mourning for Jerusalem, it's because it's still in a state of destruction, of ruin. The third Beis HaMikdash, the third temple, was not rebuilt. So you say, whoever mourns for Yerushalayim will merit and experience its simcha, its joy. Or as the expression is, if you want to be with me, if you want me to be with you when you land, you have to take me with you when you take off. So Kalamis Abala Yerushalayim, the one who's emotionally linked to Jerusalem in bad times, will merit to be there with Jerusalem in the good times. But that's not what the sages said. Sages speak about both in the present. Whoever mourns for Jerusalem, Zoyche V'roya, he merits and sees its joy. Roya is present, not future, not Yira, not will see. He sees now its joy. But that, of course, seems strange. He doesn't see now his joy. He's mourning. He's mourning for Jerusalem. He's sitting on a low chair. He's not wearing shoes. He's not eating. He's not drinking. He's not bathing. He's not showering. He's afflicting himself. He's reading Lamentations, etc. He's mourning for Jerusalem. He's not yet celebrating its rebuilding, its renovation. This question was raised by the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer, Reb Moshe Sofer, Reb Moshe Schreiber, who passed away approximately in the year 1840, the rabbi of Presburg, then in the Austria-Hungarian Empire, after the First World War. Of course, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was one of the four empires that was dissolved during the First World War. And today, Presburg is known as Bratislava. But he was the chief rabbi of Presburg, known as the Chassam Sofer, and in one of his drushes, one of his sermons that he wrote, he asks this question. I want to present today to you the moving response and answer and insight of Reb Moshe Sofer of the Chassam Sofer, which is brief and concise, but as always, to really appreciate it, to really understand what he's saying, needs context, needs introduction. We need to get the full picture to be able to fully appreciate the nuance that the sages are conveying in this above statement with this slight grammatical error, which, as we shall see, is far from an error. For this, let's change the subject, not completely, a little bit, and go to Exhibit 2. The Gemara of the Talmud in Tractate Brachos, page 28, Brachos Dav Chav Ches, tells the following story. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan, the son of Zakkai, was considered one of the greatest sages and leaders of his generation. He wasn't only a great sage, leader, thinker, teacher, shepherd of his people, but he lived at a pivotal moment. He is the man who had to not only observe, but facilitate the transition of Temple Judaism to post-Temple Judaism. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai lived during the era when the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, was destroyed by the Roman legions in the year 70 after the Common Era. The revolt against the Romans erupted in the year 66 after the Common Era. And a few years later, whether it's 68 or 69 or 70, that's still debated, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, burned the temple, murdered or exiled most of his Jews, destroyed the commonwealth. Jewish sovereignty came to an end for close to 2 millennia. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the leader of the Sanhedrin, of the spiritual Supreme Court, the most important body, legislative and spiritual leaders of the Jewish people. He was the Nasi, the leader of the Sanhedrin, of the 71 spiritual leaders of the Jewish people. And therefore, he is the man who not only watched the transition, but he is the one who felt responsible to facilitate the transition. He understood that Judaism will have to take on a completely new face. It's hard for us to understand. I'll give you an example. When we celebrate Pesach today, you have a Seder. Everybody feels like it's Pesach, especially if you stay home. You clean the house for a month. Everybody's nervous. Everybody's stressed. Everybody's exhausted. Everybody is anxious. I don't know if it has to be that way, but we're discussing the reality. And then comes the day before Pesach, and Maalof, and you're baking matzah, and you're preparing maror and charoses, and some of us squeeze juice. And finishing with bdikah and beer and mechira, erev Pesach in the morning, and burning, etc. Then comes the night of the Seder with all the anticipation, and the children come home with their booklets and their haggadahs, and they have a lot of ideas and insights and divrei Torah to occupy. And thank God, there's a lot of kids in the family, a lot of grandchildren in the family. So we sit for many hours listening to everybody's insight. And then if you're lucky enough to have a father who feels that he has many insights on the Seder, and he has read a lot for the last few weeks, everyone is responsible to listen to that as well. That's only if you're privileged to have such a person leading the Seder. And so it completely feels like Pesach between the Maror and the Charoses, and everyone is commenting how delicious the matzah is this year, and how this year the Maror did not come out too sharp. Every year the Maror doesn't come out sharp, and the matzah is unbelievably delicious this year. Sure, I want to see you serving it at your son's bar mitzvah or at the wedding, but the main thing is the matzah is delicious. Okay, Pesach is Pesach. Somebody doubts if it's Pesach. Of course it's Pesach. It feels like Pesach. It acts like Pesach. It sounds like Pesach. But imagine the Jew who experienced Pesach with the Beis HaMikdash. What did the first Pesach look like after the temple was destroyed? What did it look like? He sat down by the Seder and he was crying the whole time. He looked at his little child who was 2 years old or 3 years old or 4 years old. And with nostalgia, he tells his wife, these kids will never know what Yiddishkeit was, what Pesach was. This is a poor, it's like a picture. It's like a photograph. Rather than being at your son's wedding, you see a picture of the wedding. What do we have already? The main highlight, the key ingredient of the Seder, which was the Karban Pesach, and everything that came with the Karban Pesach was completely gone. It's obvious in the sandwich, the Korach sandwich. What do we have? We have lettuce and matzah and Nebuch. Imagine if there were lamb chops. It would have been a different Korach. That's what they used to have. Keina Sehillel. There were lamb chops. It wasn't lettuce and matzah with a little chrein. But, so for the first generation, it would have been easy to dismiss it and say Judaism came to an end. Same is true with everything. Shabbos is not Shabbos. Yom Kippur. For us, Yom Kippur is Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is not Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is Yom Kippur. Nobody knows what to do with themselves in Shul. But imagine if you experience the transition from temple to post-temple. This is Yom Kippur. Sitting in Shul and jumping down 5 times, back and up 5 times. That's Yom Kippur. That's not Yom Kippur. Talking that it was once a high priest. We take these things for granted. Somebody had to facilitate that transition and know how will Judaism survive. The man was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And hence the Mishnah Masechta Rosh Hashanah discusses the various institutions Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made after the destruction of the temple in order to perpetuate its memory, including institutions in order to prepare for the coming of Mashiach. There's one story about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai I want to focus on. When he fell ill, the Talmud says in Brachos 28, his students came in to visit him. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was weeping. They asked him why he's weeping. And one of the things he said is that when a person passes on, there are two paths in front of him. One path leads to paradise, and one path leads to Gehenna, to purgatory. Ve'eini yodea be'eze derech melichin haisi. And I do not know which path I am going to be led down. Am I going to paradise, or am I going to purgatory, to Gehenna? How can I not cry? At the end, right before he dies, he tells the students, create a chair, panu makam, make place for Chizkiya Melech Yehuda. For Chizkiya, one of the later kings of Judea, make place for him. He passes away. The commentators struggle with this comment. I don't know which path I am going to be led on. Really? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Gemara says, 40 years he learned. 40 years he taught. 40 years he led the Jewish people. Lamad, Limeid, Pirnes, Esisro. His entire life was one continuum of goodness, holiness, purity, dedication, connection, and leadership of the Jewish people. If he's not going to paradise, who is going to paradise? Now, you might say that's humility. That's not humility. Some of us think humility means lying to yourself. If I'm tall and I say I'm short, I'm not humble, I'm stupid. If I'm intelligent and I say, no, I'm dumb, I'm not humble, I'm an idiot. If I'm strong and I say I'm weak, it's not humility, it's ludicrous. If you have a certain virtue, a certain talent, physical or spiritual or emotional, not acknowledging it is not humility. We often misunderstand what humility is. We think humility is to lie, to make believe you don't have what you have or you have what you don't have. That's not humility. That humility is fake humility because you yourself know it's not true. Very important idea. When it says Moshe was the most humble person in the world, Ha'ish Moshe Anav Moed, you think Moshe looked in the mirror and said, oh, I'm a nobody, I'm a shmata, I'm valueless. Really? When Korach stood up to him, Moshe wasn't such a shmata. What happened to his humility? Throughout the whole 40 years, Moshe is never a shmata. He knows exactly what he has to do. He stands up to God, not only to the people. That's not so humble. Humility does not mean you don't know your calling. On the contrary, that's not humility. That's a form of arrogance. Fake humility is rooted in arrogance. Humility means I know exactly who I am. I know exactly my calling. I know exactly my talents, my virtues, my potentials, my abilities. And I'm humble with what I have. I'm humble because I appreciate at the end of the day that it's a gift. And that if somebody else would have had it, he or she may have developed it yet more and reached even a deeper place. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew who he was. He really thought he's going to Gehenna. Why is he going to Gehenna? His whole life was one story of Torah and Mesiras Nefesh, learning and teaching and sacrifice for the people. He really thought, I'm going to purgatory. Who's Gan Eden made for, if not you? The answer to this, my dear friends, is as follows. Sometimes you live a good life, a meaningful life, a virtuous life. You look back at your life and you could say, V'hine toiv, it was fine. I think I lived a good life. But sometimes there's one story in your life. And when you look back at that story, you often cannot forgive yourself. And it eclipses everything else. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew about the life he lived. But at the moment of truth, the moment before he returned his soul to its maker, he reflected on one moment in his long life and he asked himself, maybe this moment was a moment that I will never be able to forgive myself for. What was that moment? We now go to another story. The Talmud in Tractate Gittin, page 58, Perek HaNezak and Daf Nun Ches, tells the story in the famous discussion and elaborate few pages that deal with the history of this day of the destruction of the Second Temple and the First. Talmud tells how Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was up against a bunch of Jews who were sikrikim. They were fanatical zealots who felt that there should be no compromise with Rome. They forced the Jews into war against Rome. Many of the sages felt it was an ill-advised move. At that point in history, the logical path of the Jewish people would be to try to reconcile with Rome, to try to work with Rome. But it was an argument. It was a strong debate, and the fighting within ultimately became so ferocious that the zealots burnt down and destroyed all of the food, all the storage of food that they had in Jerusalem that would last for decades. They got rid of it, so the Jews were starving. So they were forced to go out of the city where the Roman legions were surrounding them, and they were forced into war. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai felt otherwise, and he sneaked out of the city. It wasn't easy to sneak out of the city because they wouldn't let you leave the city. He sneaked out as a corpse, as a dead man, to be buried outside of Jerusalem. And when he comes out, he goes to visit Aspasianus. Aspasianus is Vespasian. Vespasian was sent by Nero, the emperor of Rome, to be the commander-in-chief to lead the Roman legions against Jerusalem. Ultimately, as Rabbi Yochanan predicted to him, Vespasian would become the new Caesar. Aspasianus was called back to the imperial city of Rome, and as commander in lieu of him, he dispatched his son. His son was Titus, who was the general who ultimately brought down Jerusalem and burnt the temple, as the Talmud describes at length. Titus's father was Vespasian Aspasianus, who was back in Rome. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai meets Vespasian. The conversation that ensues is described in the Talmud, and Vespasian is, as we would say in English, blown away by the stature, by the presence, by the wisdom and personality of Rabbi Yochanan, to the point that he finds so much grace in his eyes that Vespasian says, "Name me your wish, and I will fulfill it. Whatever you want, I will do." Imagine the Jewish representative standing face to face in front of the most powerful person, the representative of the Caesar of Rome, who's here to crush the Jewish resistance, to bring Jerusalem to its knees, to destroy the Jewish Commonwealth, and he's asking you, what do you want? Rabbi Yochanan asks for three things, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Number one, he wants a doctor, a physician for Reb Tzadok. Reb Tzadok has been fasting for 40 years, sensing the impending destruction. He wants a physician to heal him. He wants Reb Tzadok to remain alive. Number two, he asks him to spear the family of Reb Gamliel. The family of Reb Gamliel traces its lineage back to Hillel HaZaken, Hillel the Elder, which traces back his lineage to King David, Malchus Beis David. He wants the family of Jewish royalty, of Jewish kingship, represented by Reb Gamliel in that generation. And then his son, Reb Shimon ben Gamliel, and his son, Reb Gamliel, and his son, Reb Shimon, and his son would be Reb Yehuda HaNasi, the editor of the Mishnah. He wants him to spear the family, not to destroy the family. Reb Shimon ben Gamliel himself is executed. We read about it today, one of the Asar Rugi Malchus, Reb Shimon, the son of Gamliel. But he wants the chain to remain. The third request, Tenli Yavne V'Chachameh, four words. 12 miles from Jerusalem, there's a little city called Yavne. Yavne had a yeshiva, a place medrash, where students learned Torah. Ultimately, the Sanhedrin, the spiritual supreme court, the supreme court of the Jewish people, would transport itself from Jerusalem to Yavne. Allow me to have Yavne and its sages. Don't burn Yavne. Don't destroy Yavne. Leave it intact. Let them continue studying. Let them continue teaching. Let them continue learning Torah. Vespasian agrees to all three. The Talmud says Rabbi Akiva, and some say Rabbi Yosef, were perturbed by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's decision. They asked themselves, how could you ask for such small stuff when this man offered you to do whatever you want? In fact, they applied a verse to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Meshiv Chachamim Ocher. God takes the mind of brilliant people and sometimes he sets it backwards. He takes the most brilliant people and he sets their mind backwards. If some things have to happen, they just have to happen. How could he not ask for Jerusalem, for the temple? He could have said, Vespasian, do me a favor, go home, take your wife on vacation to Hawaii or back to Rome. Lozen's true. Of course, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai felt it's not going to work. Tafasta meruba, loy tafasta. That was his calculation. You don't ask for too much because you'll get nothing. That's what he thought. But they disagreed. Now Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is on his own deathbed. And he reflects on his life. And he has to ask himself some hard questions. And he asks himself this question. Is it possible that I failed my people? Remember, how many of us are asked a question in our life that we know will transform the destiny of an entire nation? How many of us are asked in our life a question that you know that the answer to that question, on that answer, hangs the entire destiny of your people? What you say will determine the future of your people. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai looked at what happened. There was complete destruction and devastation. And he asked himself, is it not true that I may have to go to Gehenna? Is it not true that I may deserve purgatory? Maybe I had good intentions. But what do they say? Maybe it comes from here, right? The path to hell is paved with wonderful intentions. I think it applies here very well. Excellent intentions. But if I would have said something else, with one answer, I could have saved my country. I could have saved my government. I could have saved my people. I could have saved my homeland. I could have saved my temple, my Beis HaMikdash, my spiritual epicenter. I could have saved the future of the Jewish people in their organic, natural homeland. And I did not. Instead, I asked for Yavna, v'chachamah, a little Beis Medrash a few miles away. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asks himself that question. Now, you know, when you're confronted by such a question, by a man like Vespasian, how do you decide these things? These are not questions that you could look up in Shulchan Aruch. A drop of milk fell into the cholent. Is the cholent kosher or not? My fleishik spoon went into my malchika sink. I cleaned it with hot water together with cheese, dishes. Can I use the spoon? Can I not use the spoon? Etc. For this, you open up a Shulchan Aruch. You don't want to open up a Shulchan Aruch. You don't know. You call up a rabbi. You text him and you get an answer. But we're going to get this answer. You're standing in front of Vespasian. Vespasian says, what would you like, rabbi? Say, whoa, whoa, man, I got to call my rabbi. What is your rabbi going to tell you? You're not going to find this in Igros Moshe or in Pischi Tshuva. You're not going to find this in Shal Tshuva's Yabia Omer or Eretz Svi. You're not going to find a Rajba or Rebbe Akiva Eger, a Shach, or a Taz, or a Sma, or a Prima Godim, that addresses this. These are questions you have to decide like this, with your gut, with your kishkas, with your heart, with your soul. There's nobody to ask. He made a decision, and on his deathbed, he asks himself, did I fail my people or did I not? The question we have to ask now is, we're living almost 2,000 years later. Where did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai end up? Where did he deserve to end up? He couldn't know the answer. He was too close. Hindsight is 20/20, but he didn't have hindsight. He lived through the period. But this happened in the year 70 after the Common Era. We stand today in the year 2017 after the Common Era. That's how many years later? Was like a mathematician. 1947? Exactly. We like exact. Anybody here with numbers? If not, I'm going to have to do it. Yeah? Okay, 1947. 1,900, I'm relying on you. 1,947 years later. It's a shipshit site. It's a nice couple of years. They once asked a Chinese politician, what's your opinion of the American Revolution and the French Revolution? He says, it's too early to tell. 250 years, 300 years. Those are babies. Americans are a bunch of babies. Come, three centuries. You're dealing here with 19, almost 2,000 years. There's a lot of hindsight, a lot of perspective. Not many nations have been around for 2,000 years. We live in America. We're thankful for America. A few hundred years old. That's it. We have hindsight. We have perspective. In 1989, the Dalai Lama summoned 10 Jews for a meeting. One of the Jews who was there, his name is Roger Kamenetz, recorded the conversation in a book called The Jew and the Lotus. The Dalai Lama raised with them a fascinating question. I'm just fascinated by the fact that he called in Jews to discuss this dilemma. And this was his problem. He and his tribe and his religion were exiled by the Chinese from Tibet in the 1950s. They have been exiled in India for close to a half a century, more than a half a century. And he comes to the Jews and he says, I have a problem. Not living in our organic homeland for close to 50 years, I do not know how we are going to manage to give over our traditions to the next generation. We're in exile, ultimately, in another country. So who did I call? I summoned the people who have managed somehow to do this well. They have been in exile for millennia, scattered all over the world, and nonetheless, for the most part, many of them managed to maintain their identity with pride, with dignity, with determination, and with conviction. And they're still thriving as a culture, as a people, as a religion, as a faith. I want to know how you did it. He understood this is a question you have to ask from the experts. Who are the experts? The Jews. I'm not going to tell you what they answered him, because I'm not sure I agree with their answer. But I'm going to tell you what I would have answered if I would have been in that delegation. I actually don't know if I would have answered, because I don't know if it's so relevant to him. But what's the real answer? The answer to this question comes from a strange and interesting mitzvah. There's a mitzvah in Parshas Truma. In the portion of Truma in the book of Exodus, we're commanded to build the Mishkan, the sanctuary, the tabernacle. And the piece of furniture that was most pivotal in the sanctuary was the Aron, the Ark, which contained the two luchas, the two tablets with the Ten Commandments in the Holy of Holies in the Mishkan and the sanctuary, later transported to the Holy of Holies in the temple on the Temple Mount in Solomon's, Shlomo HaMelech's first temple, and which then later was hidden or exiled. There's one mitzvah, and that is the Ark, the Aron, which is a box, a container, needs to have badim. It needs to have steingen, poles, staves. I don't mean to bring up nightmares here for the Chede Ingelach. But poles, staves, right? Poles. Why do you need poles? The Mishkan had to be transported. True, they were in Kaddish for 19 years, but still, you have to transport. They were traveling. How are you going to transport an ark? You had badim, just like you had on the other pieces of furniture. On the table, the shulchan, the mizbechas, the altars, they all had staves, they all had poles. But by the ark, there's a special commandment. Lo yasuru habadim mimenu. Never take away the poles. The poles always have to remain in the ark, ready to go. Very strange mitzvah. In fact, somebody who removes the poles from the ark is violating a mitzvah sloisasa with the penalties of malchus. It's a serious transgression. A strange mitzvah. Imagine you purchase a beautiful piece of art, a Van Gogh, a Raphael, a Picasso for your living room or your salon. It cost you $29 million in original. Anybody? You hang it up. You hang it up in your living room. It's the pracht of your house. You make sure to make many shalom zachas in your house just to get people jealous. And so, it comes in the special packed up suitcase, protected with many, many layers. And as you take out the piece of art, the painting, and you hang it up, you keep the suitcase there. And your wife asks you, why do you keep the suitcase? And you say, well, one day we've got to move. And we need the suitcase to be able to transport it. So she says, when we move, we'll bring up the suitcase from storage. In the meantime, suitcases you leave in storage, you don't leave it in the living room right under the picture. Quite logical, right? And unless you're having other issues, you don't argue with her about this. Unless you have other issues, so you just need to argue. You have to move the ark, you'll bring up the poles. In the Holy of Holies, you have to have poles. Pasnisht. Leave the aron there. Take the sticks, put them in a corner. When you have to move, you'll bring them back. Not only that, they were in one place for 19 years. What do you need the poles for 19 years? They came to Shiloh. In Shiloh, the sanctuary existed for you know how many years? 369 years. 369 years you need poles? For what? Why? Lo yasura habadam. Why? The answer to this question was presented by two people. One by the Meshech Chachma, the Ursa Meach, Reb Meir Simcha Kohen of Dvinsk, a few decades before him, by Reb Shimshon Rafal Hirsch, in his commentary on Chumash, just like Reb Meir Simcha Kohen in his commentary on Chumash. They say it briefly. I'll just present their insight the way I understood it, with some elaboration. There was a profound message here, and it goes back to the wisdom of Reb Yochanan ben Zakkai, when he's standing in front of Vespasian. You see? He is standing in front of the Roman emperor. He knows the man is determined to destroy the temple, to destroy Jerusalem. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is standing in front of the most powerful person in the world. But he's thinking, how am I going to save my people? How will we survive? He knew this. When the temple gets destroyed, when the spiritual epicenter of the Jewish people is gone, when we have no Jerusalem anymore, no Beis HaMikdash, no central power, no commonwealth, no sovereignty, no political or military independence, will we survive? Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe very challenging, maybe very difficult. But he knew this. If we lose our connection to Torah, with no way we're going to survive. If we don't bring physical sheep every morning to the temple, a sheep in the morning, a sheep in the afternoon. If Shabbos comes and we don't have the offerings known as the Musafim. If Passover comes and we don't have the offerings known as Pesach. Yom Kippur comes, we don't have the offerings of Yom Kippur. We don't have the goat and we don't have the bull. We don't have the blood in the Holy of Holies and we don't have the burning incense. Will we survive? Maybe very challenging. But what he did know is, if we don't learn about the sheep, if we don't learn about the Karbonos of Yom Kippur, if we don't have the ability anymore to master Masechta Yuma or Masechta Zvachim, Menachos Ubchairis, Tmura Krisos, if we don't learn anymore about Kachim Kadoshim and Kachim Kalim, Kal Haroyu Lebila Pigul, Noiser, Kedushas Mechitzas, etc. If we don't learn anymore about Trumas and Maisers, about Tumas and Tyrus, about the Azara versus the Hechel, Ezra's Koyanim versus Ezra's Yisrael, all the components that deal with the study, the learning, the understanding of the offerings of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Jewish relationship with God, then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew there's no way that the Jewish people will be able to survive. And that was the secret of the poles. Why were the poles always there by the ark? The sanctuary became the center of the Jewish people. Later, it would be Jerusalem, the Holy Temple, the Holy of Holies, and the ark. Usually, what happens to a nation when they're thrown out of their land? What happens to a nation when they're expelled, when they're exiled? They naturally assimilate. You can't expect anything else. When you become a minority among a majority, you want to fit in. Especially if there's pressure, especially if there's discrimination, especially if there's bigotry, never mind persecution. You naturally surrender, you acclimate, you become part of the majority. There's no way you could maintain a strong identity if you're not running the show. Others are running the show and they don't want you to be different. On the contrary, they will crush you for being different. The R and the Ark had poles. What was the message of the poles? The message of the poles was this. You also have a homeland. You also have a center. But I want to tell you about your homeland. You have a portable homeland. Your homeland is portable. As long as this ark, this Arun, you will take with you wherever you go around the world. In all of your journeys, you will take this Arun. Those poles will not come off. It will always allow itself to be transportable. you will never, ever forfeit your identity and your eternity. Because wherever you will be in your homeland. Fascinating. This observation was made by none other than a Jew who converted. His name was Heinrich Heine. He was a German Jew. To get a ticket into university, you couldn't as a Jew. He converted, he became a Protestant, not because he believed in Christianity, simply because he wanted to have a career in the university. He was a brilliant man. He was a poet, he was a writer. And he lived in the 18th century. And he was once speaking with German intellectuals, and they started to make fun of the Jewish people. They said, you don't even have a homeland. You're parasites. This is the 18th century, the 1700s. Jews are living among their host nations, whether it's Germany, France, Britain, or in the countries of Eastern Europe, or anywhere else. And Heine tells his colleagues, the Germans, he says, you're making a mistake. The Jewish people have a homeland. It's a portable homeland, and it's called the Torah. Indeed, this has become the story of the Jewish people. A Jew is living in Sosnovitz, in Odessa, in Krakow, in Lodz, in Lublin. He's coming home from a hard day at work, a hard, difficult day at work. And he comes into his home, or he walks into the shul to the Beis Medrash, and he opens up a Gemara. He opens up a Mishnah. He opens up a Chumash. He opens up a Tanakh. He opens up a work of Halacha or any work of Torah. And he starts learning. And where is he? He's in Jerusalem. He's in the Holy Temple. He's in the Holy of Holies. He's in the Ark. He or she is in their organic homeland, wherever they were. It's a portable homeland. Somebody once sent me a story. It would be interesting to verify if it's historically accurate. It was quite amusing. Queen Victoria from Britain was once vacationing in Germany. Her husband came from Germany originally, and she was vacationing in Hanover. She was pregnant, but she still had 2 months scheduled to deliver the baby. Lo and behold, she started to feel as otot, the baby's coming out. Now you do realize the crisis, don't you? Queen Victoria is going to have a baby on which soil? German soil. There's not enough time to go back to Britain. It could be too dangerous. If the baby is born on German soil, he could never become the future heir to the British throne. He has to be born on British soil. Vos Titman, crisis. Victoria is having her baby, and this baby will not even be able to rule. 2 months early, it's her problem. She went on vacation. She didn't realize sometimes vacation has interesting results. Bas Tutman, here's a classic Jewish moment. Moshe Montefiore, Sir Moses Montefiore, who was one of the great Jews of his day, a great philanthropist, an Askin, an activist, a great man, went to Shul for Mincha Ma'ariv. He was a close advisor to the royal palace in Britain, to the royal court in Britain. He went to Shul for Mincha Ma'ariv in Hanover. Who was the rabbi? Reb Nosson Adler. So what do Jews do between Mincha and Ma'ariv? They solve the world's problems. That's what Jews in a good shul do between Mincha and Ma'ariv. They discuss the world's problems and they solve it. That's what it is. Today it's the comments and the websites took over that position. The Jews in the comments solve all the world's problems. But it used to be in Shul between Mincha Ma'ariv, that was the official calling. You bring up the issue and you solve the problem and you tell the presidents, the prime ministers and the kings what to do and what not to do. And of course with absolute conviction and certainty, since they will usually call you right after Ma'ariv. And so, but in this case, it wasn't funny. They were actually solving the world's problems. Reb Nosson Adler sees that Moshe Montefiore is bazarked. He's worried. He's perturbed. He says, Reb Moshe, what's going on? He tells him there's a crisis. There's a crisis. Queen Victoria decided to give birth a little 2 months early. And this is going to be a major churban for the British royal court. Reb Nosson Adler says, what's the problem? Take a British ship. Go out 3 kilometers into the water. Hanover is on the coast. 3 kilometers in the water is international waters. It's not German soil anymore. And if the baby is born on a British ship, the baby is British. It was born on British soil. Solve the problem. And so King Edward was born, and Reb Nosson Adler ultimately becomes the first chief rabbi of Britain and the United Kingdom, the one who allowed King Edward to be able to become the king of Britain. You see, this is the Jewish skill, the Jewish talent. How do you retain identity as Mamleches Koyanim v'Goy Kodesh, as a kingdom of princesses on foreign soil? They did it for the British. They did it for themselves. How do you retain your identity out in the sea, out in the ocean, out in other people's countries? It was because their Aaron always had Badim, always had poles, always had staves. I want to share with you a story. It's quite a loaded story, not very known as well, which I think in an interesting way also brings out this point. In April 1912, the Titanic embarked on its great journey from England, destined to New York. The Titanic, as its name indicates, was singular both in size and in majesty. They said then that it was the unsinkable ship. As somebody said, even God himself could not sink the Titanic. The Titanic cost, in the early 1900s, to make $750,000, which today, $7,500,000, which today would be equivalent to $400 million. That was the price of the building of the Titanic. The lowest fare for third class passage in the Titanic was $36.25 one way for a single person who was willing to share a cabin. Second class, starting fare was $66. First class started at $125, but can go up to $4,500. $4,500 for a first class ticket in 1912 was a fabulous sum of money, because at that time you could purchase a house for less than $1,000. Not bad, huh? $1,000, you could purchase a house. If you only would have lived then, Amichaya, you would have been so wealthy today. You could have bought up the whole Forche and Fifth Avenue and Madison Avenue too. And therefore, they called it the Millionaire Suite. The Titanic left Southampton, England on Wednesday, April 10th, 1912, 23rd day of Nissan. Tofresh Ayin Beis, 5-7-12, one day after Pesach, one day after Passover, towards New York. Among the passengers was an 18-year-old young Jewish woman. Her name was Leah Aks, A-K-S, Leah Aks. She traveled with a 10-month-old baby. His name was Ephraim Fischel. Frank Philip, his nickname Philly. Ephraim Fischel, Ox, with his mother, 18-year-old Leah. Leah was born in Warsaw, in Poland, in Warsaw. Her family immigrated from Poland to England. In London, she met a young Jewish man named Shmuel, or Sam. Leah and Shmuel took a liking for each other. He was a tailor who also came from Warsaw to England, and they got married to each other. One day, a cousin of Shmuel, who lived in America, came to visit his cousin Sam in London. And he tells him, what are you schlepping around here as a tailor in England? If you would only come to America, you would be able to make a lot of money. Jews then called the United States of America the Golden Medina, because in their imagination, the streets were paved with gold and the trees produced not leaves, but gold. Whereas Sam Levinson once said, he said, my father, when he came to America, he was told that the streets are paved with gold. And then when he actually arrived in America, he discovered three things. First of all, the streets were not paved with gold. Second of all, the streets were not paved at all. And third of all, he is the one who has to pave them. So this was the perspective of America. Now we're still looking for the copper. If we could find some copper, would also be good. But let's not complain. Compared to the poverty of those days, it's really extraordinary what we have in America. Leah was at this time expecting her first child. Her parents felt that in her condition, she shouldn't make the trip from England to create a new home in the United States. She's drug addict, she's pregnant. Rather, let Shmuel travel alone. He'll set up home, he'll set up shop. And then when the baby is born and she's feeling better, she'll join her husband in the United States. So Sam traveled alone. He set up home in Norfolk, Virginia. And they were waiting for Leah to give birth. Leah gave birth to a baby. They made a bris. His name was Ephraim Fishel. And now they were planning to head to America. He was 10 months old. She was strong enough. He was strong enough to be able to make this long trip from England to America. They were booked on an earlier ship leaving to the U.S. also in April 1912. But as usual the case, the Jewish mother intervenes. This is a classic behavior. And so Leah's mother mixed in. And she said, I'm reading in the newspapers about the Titanic. You can't go in this other Fahakta ship. We need you to go in the Titanic. So they canceled the ticket that they had on the earlier ship. And they put her, they've got her a ticket, third class steerage. They weren't wealthy, in the Titanic. She said, you need a gigantic ship, a safe ship, a sturdy ship, the best and safest ocean liner that existed till that time. And it's making its historic maiden voyage to New York. It's the first time ever the Titanic was embarking on its first journey. Leia's mother was convinced that she has to travel on the world's safest ocean liner. One day after Pesach, April 10th, 1912, Leah Ox and her baby Ephraim Fishel, together with many other passengers, they board the ship in Southampton in England. There's fanfare, there is ceremony. They were in a third-class cabin, which was called steerage, together with many other immigrants to America. 4 days later, shortly before midnight on April 14th, as the ship was 95 miles south of the Grand Banks in Newfoundland, it struck an iceberg. The iceberg that the Titanic struck was 100 feet over the deck. That's how tall it was. Now 90% of an iceberg is hidden beneath the water. So this iceberg was literally a mountain of ice, close to 1,000 feet from bottom to top. Most of it, of course, was under the water. Its massive knife-like edges beneath the water surface punctured and gashed the ship along 250 feet of its hull. 20 minutes later, after consulting with the ship's designer, whose name was Andrews, the captain of the ship, whose name was Edward Smith, realized that the Titanic would sink within 2 hours. Everyone on board would lose their lives unless they would get onto lifeboats and then be rescued by other passing ships in the water. Now the tragedy became clear. There were not enough spaces in the lifeboats for everyone. There were 2,200 passengers and crew on board. There was room only for 1,178 people on lifeboats. More than 1,000 people would surely die. The boat begins tilting. There's absolute panic. There's pandemonium. There's confusion. There's hollering, fear, uncertainty. The captain and the crew order that women and children would be saved first. In the third cabin, third class cabin, women and children are ordered in front of the men, in order to go in front of the men to be saved. Leah Ox, the Jewish young woman from Warsaw, is holding her 10-year-old baby, Ephraim Fishel, in her arms, and she's trying to get from the third class cabin in steerage to the deck to be able to get on one of the lifeboats. The problem is that the gate in front of her cabin jammed and no one could get out. She's standing pressed against the gate, screaming for help. A sailor sees her with her little baby in her arms. He reaches over the gate. He lifts her and her child up so she could run to the deck where women and children are being put into lifeboats. Most of the people in the third-class cabin did not get out. They could not get to the deck. 75% of them indeed drowned. Leah runs up to the deck with her child, and she's waiting. She's waiting by the edge of the deck, trying to get online to get into one of the lifeboats to be rescued. It was frighteningly cold. Remember, this is the middle of the night. It's freezing. People are shoving. People are pushing. People are screaming. People are trying to get onto lifeboats. Down below, the water mercilessly is gushing into the Titanic, into its gaping holes. The ship is getting filled of water. The whole bottom of the ship is now flooded. Leia is on the deck, shivering from cold together with her son. One of the wealthiest women on board was a woman named Lady Madeline Astor. She sees her and her baby huddled against the cold. Lady Astor herself was 5 months pregnant. She had an 8-foot, beautiful, warm shawl. She removes it. She gives it to Leia and she says, "Here, wrap your baby. It's so cold out here." Her teeth are shattering. Leia thanks her profusely. In fact, Lady Astor survived. Her husband perished, and her baby was born 4 months later, and she named him after his father. During this time, a man pushed himself into a lifeboat that was about to be lowered into the water. When the cabin steward saw him, they forced him out of the boat, pulled him back on deck, yelling that women and children come first. This man managed to jump into another lifeboat, waiting for it to be lowered. He was determined to be saved. Again, they fought with him. They schlepped him out of the second lifeboat, and they put him back on the deck, insisting that women and children must be given priority. The man saw Leia Ox, standing with Ephraim Fischel there on the deck. He was enraged. His eyes were wild as he stalked back and forth, consumed by anger, madness, and frustration. In a demented moment of madness, he runs towards Leia and he screams, "You think women are first? You think children are first? I'll show you." He grabs the infant from Leia's arms and he throws him overboard. Leia shrieks in horror. Her child was just thrown into the ocean. The men on board attack this man, but it's too late. The deed has been done. The child has been thrown overboard. The poor baby is gone. People are yelling and screaming, and now it's Leia's turn to get on the lifeboat. "I won't go without my baby," she cries. The officers tell her, "You have to save your own life. Your baby is lost. What are you going to gain by dying as well? You need to save your own life. There's no point in staying on a ship. It's going to sink." They literally schlep her. They try to console her. She's crying hysterically. And they just take her and place her on a lifeboat that is lowered into the water. She comes down to the middle of the Atlantic. Her lifeboat's number is 13. She is together with 63 other people. 2:20 a.m., the Titanic went down. With every passing minute, the cries for help from those dying in the water faded away. It was only at daybreak, April 15th, 1912, that the liner Carpathia arrived and rescued the survivors from the lifeboats. (clears throat) 1,523 souls slipped into the icy waters of the North Atlantic and drowned. 1,523 souls out of the 2,200 passengers on the Titanic. Leia was shattered. Her life was saved. Her baby literally thrown into the ocean. She took to the mattress on the Carpathia for 2 days. She would not move. She could not console herself. There was another Titanic survivor by the name of Selena Cook. Selena Cook urged Leia to come up on the deck for air. She refused. She says, come, you need some fresh air. She schleps Leia out to the deck of the Carpathia just to breathe a little bit. Leia is grief-stricken. And suddenly Leia sees on the Carpathia a woman holding a child. Leia hears the child crying. The voice of this child sounds too familiar. Leia comes closer, and the child sees Leia, and the child lunges, the child moves towards Leia. She recognizes the child. It was Ephraim Fischel. That's my baby. That's my child. You see, unknown to Leia, as the madman threw the baby overboard, he fell into the hands of a woman sitting on lifeboat number 11. This woman, who already went down in a lifeboat, was a Catholic woman. Her name was Elizabeth Nye. She was pregnant. She was saved, lifeboat 11. Her husband was not permitted to follow his pregnant wife into the lifeboat. Elizabeth Nye's husband perished. He drowned. She was a firm Catholic believer. As she's sitting on the boat, suddenly a child falls into her arms. She begins to believe that God sent her a child as a replacement for her dead husband and as a brother for the child who she's carrying in her womb. This child is going to be born as an orphan. He won't have a father. Now he'll have at least a brother. God sent from heaven a child. Elizabeth Nye is holding a Jewish baby. She's dressed in a long black dress with a huge cross. She tells Leia, it's not your child. It's God's child. It's not your child. The child was entrusted by the Lord to me. On the deck of the Carpathia, the woman who cared for Philly since the Titanic sank refused to give Leia the child. Leia goes to the captain of the Carpathia, who now becomes King Solomon, who has to determine which mother is saying the truth. You remember the story, right? Which mother is saying the truth? Thank God he did not say, take a knife. He did not say that. His name was Arthur Rustin. Arthur Rustin was the captain of the Carpathia. He is now put in the role of Shlomo HaMelech of King Solomon, deciding who the real mother. Leia is crying hysterically. This is my baby. This is my son. Mrs. Nye is insisting that it's her child. Leia has no proof. She decided it's her child. She would not be denied this child. Arthur Rustin, takes both women and he says, come with me to my quarters. My private quarters there, we could sit and I could reflect on the matter further. In the captain's quarters, he's investigating. He speaks to this one, he speaks to this one. Leia suddenly calls out, she says, I have proof that this is my child. Captain Rustin says, what's the proof? 18-year-old Leia says firmly and with certainty, she says, I am Jewish. My son is circumcised. He had a bris. You have to understand, not like America today, in Europe at that time, only Jewish children were circumcised. The baby was undressed. Sure it was, black and white. The baby had a bris. When Captain Rustin saw this, he took 10-month-old Ephraim Fischel and returned him back to his mother, Leia. The Carpathia brought all the survivors from the lifeboats to New York. Mother and baby were united with father, with Shmuel, who came, of course, to greet his wife and his baby in what has become an eventful trip. 9 months later, Leia, who was now with her husband, gave birth to another baby. Deeply grateful to Captain Rustin and his crew on the Carpathia who saved them from their lifeboats in the North Atlantic, Leia named her daughter Sarah Carpathia Ox. God always has it his way. The nuns at the hospital in Norfolk, Virginia, got confused
And instead of naming the baby Sarah Carpathia Ox, they named the baby Sarah Titanic Ox. And that remained her name for life. Sarah Titanic Ox became her name. Ephraim Fishel grew up in Norfolk in Virginia with his mom and sister and dad, with Sarah, with Leah, with Shmuel. As a proud Jew, he would walk for miles every Shabbos to daven in the Orthodox shul in Norfolk, Virginia, known as the Cumberland Street Shul. He would walk literally miles every single Shabbos to daven in that shul. He never forgot how fortunate he was to survive. He was given not one life, but three lives. He was given one life like everybody else. His second life when he was saved from the Titanic going under, and his third life when he was saved from this madman throwing him literally overboard. He could have perished with the other 15, 23 people, but God spared him, and his bris ensured that he was returned to his mother. Leah died in 1967. Ephraim Fishel died not so long ago. He died in July 1991. I tell you this story not only because it's a fascinating story, but it captures the Jewish story. It's one story about an individual and his mother, but it captures the Jewish story. Because the Titanic sunk, the ship that was not sinkable sunk. And the Jewish people did not sink. And the question is how that happened. And here we come back to the insight of the Chasam Sofer. So I visited a camp on Sunday. This Sunday, I had a Shabbaton in Pine Tree in the Catskills. And Sunday, I went to speak at a very nice camp, hundreds of children. And at the end of my speech, I asked the boys to ask questions. So one of the boys, 13 or 14 years old, he asked the following question. He said, "Rabbi Jacobson, this week we had no meat. All we had for 9 days is fish. I hate fish. I love meat. Why in the world can't we have meat?" I said, "What did they tell you? What did they tell you when you grew up why you can't have meat?" They said, "Because it's the 9 days and you're not allowed to have meat." But I don't understand. Why should they make us miserable? Why would they deprive us from it? I want to eat. What's wrong with just eating a normal meal? Why does this religion want to make me miserable? That was the question. Anybody here ever asked this question? What was the response you got? Anybody? You asked this question? You had it. You never asked it. Okay. That's my job, to articulate the questions that everyone thinks about and nobody asks. Or some think about, not everybody, some think about. I actually was very happy he asked the question because it allowed for a genuine conversation. I'll tell you what I told him. I can't vouch that it was a good answer, although I thought it was a good answer, but I could vouch that when I finished, he was going like this. Like this. He was nodding with almost enthusiasm. I'm not going to say it turned his fish into the taste of paradise and he lost his love for meat in the 9 days, but he was very extremely agreeable, I would say, like almost emotionally satisfied with the answer. I said, "I'll tell you something. I know exactly how you feel. I also like meat. I like all foods, and I like fish too, but I also like meat. I don't discriminate. I have respect for all animals. Especially if they end up in my abdomen. I have even more respect for them." So, when was the last time you had meat? I said, "I want to explain to you something about your people. We could naturally say, 9 days. What happened in these 9 days? 1,947 years ago, some Roman troops came, breached the wall of a city, 3 weeks penetrated the city, and the 9 days got closer and closer and closer to the Temple Mount, put the temple on flames. It happened 1,947 years ago. Not only that, it happened once more 500 years earlier with the first temple. And we could say, you know, I'm dealing with my life today. I don't know what happened last week to me. I'm still trying to figure out what happened yesterday. Now you want me not to change my diet based on what happened almost 2,000 years ago? I mean, let's face it. I don't know who they were. I don't feel it. I don't have anything with these 9 days. I got my own issues. And I just don't feel connected. So you'll tell me stories after stories after stories. You'll read Eicha and you'll read Kinnis and you'll tell me about the 9 days. And you'll tell me about Tlosa de Peronius and Shiva de Nechemte and Chazon Yeshayo. I just don't feel connected. I said, but you're 14 years old. And I want you to understand how our people function, how we operate. I want to tell you, we consider it a duty to ourselves and to our children to always remember that we're part of a story and to always keep in our memory every Jew who lived, breathed, danced, cried, laughed, suffered, lived or died as a Jew. Yes, be very proud of the fact that 2,000 years later, every year you and your friends tell a story. You tell a story about a brother and a sister, children of the high priest, Rabbi Shmuel, taken into captivity. And the masters say to each other, we have just captured and bought slaves from Jerusalem, the nicest of the nicest. Literally, their faces project the brilliance of the sun. If we could just marry these two slaves to each other, their children will be beyond extraordinary and they all belong to us. Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol's son hears that he's going to marry tomorrow morning a slave, non-Jewish, and she hears the same. And the whole night they're locked up in one room and they're weeping about their fate. Remember, their father was murdered, not just murdered, murdered brutally. And this is their fate. As the sun rises, they recognize each other, brother and sister, and they hug and they embrace so tightly their souls expire. I said, now think about it. 2,000 years passed. We remember that boy and that girl. We think about them. We talk about them. Be proud of your people that they don't just move on and forget their past. Every Jew who went up in the flames, we remember them. We pay tribute to them. Every mother, every child, every father. We speak about Rabbi Akiva, we speak about Rabbi Chutzpis, we speak about Rabbi Chanina ben Tradian, we speak about Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, we speak about Rabbi Elazar HaShamua, as though they were our Rebbes, our colleagues, our teachers. Danny Goldhagen wrote a book called Hitler's Willing Executioners. He accused the entire German people in being part of the Holocaust, not just the Nazis. Harvard professor, Jewish professor, in Berlin at a lecture after he gave out the book, a professor says, it's 60 years since the Holocaust, it's time to forget. Goldhagen says, 1900 years ago, we had a house on top of a mountain in Jerusalem. It burned down. 60 times a day we remember it. We're not going to forget what happened in Auschwitz 60 years ago. You open up a kinnas and you go through Jewish history. Yes, be proud of the fact that in 1096, the Crusaders marched through the communities of Speyer, Mainz, Worms, Magenza, Speyer, Vermeise, on the Rhine River in Germany, and murdered its communities. And we speak about that in the kinnas. Be proud of the fact that in the 13th century, in the month of Tammuz, they burned 24 wagons of the Talmud in Paris, and we speak about it, Shali Srufa Be'esh. Be proud of the fact that Yehuda Halevi in Spain speaks about Tziyayin Aloysish Ali L'Shloim Asirayich. They go through the first crusade, the second crusade, the third crusade. You may not feel what happened in the 9 days, but be proud that you're part of a people that speaks about the past as though it was present. I was debating somebody at a lecture. He said that he thinks Tisha B'Av should be abolished. It should be removed from the calendar. I said, why? He said, you're asking for the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is rebuilt. He says, come to Jerusalem. What he's saying in Nachem, comfort this, we're soon going to say in Mincha, Nachem, this city that's Avela, Bzuya, Shemema, desolate. It's a beautiful city. You guys buy real estate there for millions of dollars. Really, that's your desolate Jerusalem? What are you such hypocrites? He says, you're hypocrites. You say it's desolate, but then you're charging $10 million. That's what you charge for desolateness? He says, come to Brooklyn, it's much worse. For a garage, they can take $2 million. He says, demolish it. I said, do you think Jews should remember? He said, do you remember? Do you believe in memory? He says, what are you? It's old and we're already gone. We already have a nation. We came back to Israel. I said, I have a question. When I'm in Israel and the siren goes off on Yom HaShoah, on the Holocaust Remembrance Day, or Yom HaZikaron, when they remember the soldiers who fell in battle, the terrorist victims, there's some Jews who specially don't stop by the siren. They feel they're not part of this whole culture. That's not how they remember the fallen. And they don't stop. They continue walking. And I once asked one of them, maybe you're hurting the feelings of people who suffer terribly. He said, well, this is not a Jewish thing. It's a secular Zionist thing. I don't have to be part of it. I said, this is very interesting to me. There may be a mother there who buried a child. For her, the siren is the way that she and the country respect her child. I'm sure that instead of standing by the siren, you're going to shul and you're learning a perek mishnayos for the soldier. I'm sure about that. Or if not, you should find out his name from the mother and learn the prakim of mishnayos. But she doesn't know yet about mishnayos. For her, it's the siren. Don't you think, you speak always in your yeshivas, they always speak about hakaras hatoiv, showing appreciation, noise ba'ol chaveri, being sensitive to other people, not embarrassing somebody in public. The mother who buried her child, don't you think it's an outcry? It's an act of cruelty not to show just basic sensitivity. La'avdil, even an animal, there's a mitzvah of tzar b'lechayim midoraisa. Here's another fellow Jew. Why don't you? He didn't understand what I was saying. Okay, it's another topic. But I say to him, this man, do you stop at the siren Yom HaShoah? He says, of course. I honor the Holocaust victims. We have to always remember the Holocaust victims. Always remember the Holocaust victims. I say, but Israel rebuilt itself. He says, yeah, but it doesn't take away from the tragedy of the Holocaust. He said, now I want to tell you something. There are still Holocaust survivors living today. You had parents who were Holocaust survivors. You grew up with people on the numbers in their arms. You knew it. But I want to tell you something. In 50 years from now, in 100 years from now, in 900 years from now, the Holocaust is going to be like Churban Bayis Sheni. Churban Bayis Sheni. Look what happens Tisha B'Av in Israel. There's two groups of people. There are people who go and sit on the floor and say Eicha. And then there are people who wonder why Tisha B'Av is disturbing a hot summer, beautiful vacation day in August in the Holy Land. And they go to the beach, they go to the cafes, they sip iced coffee. They say it happened 1900 years ago. It's exactly what they're going to say about the Holocaust. Do you understand the moment you divorce the Jewish people from memory, from the past? You say, the Holocaust, I remember. The Spanish Inquisition, I don't remember. The Crusades, I don't remember. Churban Bayis Rishon, it's my problem. You ultimately sever the connection to the Holocaust victims as well. It's because of this power of the Jewish people that it comes the night of Tisha B'Av and we say that 3,300 years ago on this night, the spies came back and they dissuaded the people from going into the land and they created mass hysteria. 3,500 years ago, we remember that Jews were weeping because they were fearful in vain out of a pending disaster that didn't exist. And we remember that event 3,500 years ago. So I told this camper, I said, I also like beet. But I think the value of being connected to such a people probably trumps the taste of meat for 9 days. You may not emotionally identify with what happened, I know. How could you? It didn't happen to you or your mother. It happened long ago. But just appreciate the nature of this people. Appreciate this reality. Comes the Chasam Sofer and says, Kol ha-mis'abel al Yerushalayim, Zoyche v'roye b'simchasa. Not in the future, now. If you mourn for Jerusalem, you see its joy. Why? The Torah says in Genesis, Parshas Vayeshev, Joseph was killed apparently. Jacob was told that he was devoured by a wild animal. And he felt that he was died, but he couldn't find comfort. Why couldn't he find comfort? He couldn't find comfort. So the Medrash says, Gzeira al hachai sheyishtakech min alev, avalei al ames. Gzeira al ames sheyishtakech min alev, avalei al hachai. If somebody dies, God forbid, there's a certain program that the Creator put into the world that we try to move on. It's not easy. It always comes with much pain and grief. But there is a certain human resource, ability, to say we have to move on. We don't forget, but we move on. That's if somebody died. If somebody is alive, you can't move on. You can't forget. You can't tell Gilad Shalit's parents when he was 5 years in captivity by Hamas, Gilad Shalit, tell the parents, oh, closure. You can't have closure. The hope that he's still going to come out one day doesn't allow you to go to sleep and say, he died, because you don't know if he died. Yaakov couldn't find comfort for Yosef because he was alive. He didn't know that he was alive, but because he was alive, he couldn't come to grips with it. He couldn't just say, a chapter ended and a new one has to begin. Whoever mourns for Jerusalem, and the question is, how can one mourn for Jerusalem? It's been 2,000 years. So much water has come under the bridge. Jews have been through so much. How could people still mourn for something and someone that lived 2,000 years ago? I mean, how old-fashioned can you be? Zoyche v'roye b'simchasa. He merits and sees the joy now. The very fact that Jews speak about Jerusalem, they speak about the Beis HaMikdash, they speak about Eretz Yisrael, that means that it's alive. It's not dead. If it would have been dead, the chapter is over. You forget. You forget. You light a yahrzeit candle once a year, and after a few generations, that stops too. Who says Kaddish today for people who lived 200 years ago, 300 years ago, 400 years ago? Well, how are they mourning for Jerusalem? Why do they continue the story? Because it's not a mace. It's a chai. It's alive. If it's alive, it's alive now. If it's alive now, people still can't come to grips with its loss. So he says, Zoyche v'roye b'simchasa. They merit and see its joy now. That itself is the joy that never really died. It's alive, and that's why it will yet come back to full life. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai stood in front of Vespasian, he understood all of this. He knew that he has to ask for something that will guarantee the eternity of the Jewish people. He asked for Yavna. What was Vespasian thinking? Vespasian looked at the rabbi. He says, he's a smart guy, but he's not too smart. Here is Rome, the epicenter of the might of the modern world. Rome was the superpower of civilization. Yavna is a little shtibel, probably looked like this tent, probably a little smaller, not decorated so nicely. I'll spare Yavna, big deal. Little did Vespasian know that by acquiescing to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's request, he himself was signing the death certificate for the Roman Empire. It's always how history works. Ultimately, evil has to be transformed into goodness. Darkness has to be transformed into light. And therefore, light can always be found in the darkness. Vespasian himself was ultimately the one who was signing the death certificate for the Roman Empire and the life certificate for the Jewish people by telling Rabbi Yochanan, of course you can have Yavna v'chachamah. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, I don't know if I'm going to go to paradise or purgatory. We understand his question very well. We, who live almost 2,000 years later, now turn to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and say, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, now it's time for us to ask you the following question. Where is Vespasian? Where is Titus? Where is Caliglia? Where is Pompey? Where is Julius? Where is Adrian? Where are they? Where is Turkomedei? Where is Nebuchadnezzar? Paroi? Haman? Where is Bogdan Khmelnytsky? Where is Alfred Rosenberg, Himmler, Mengele, Stalin? Where are they? The answer is they are in Wikipedia. That's where they are. You could Google right now, Wikipedia, Google their name, and you'll have a nice Wikipedia entry on Vespasian and Titus, with even a picture, an engraved statue of them, exactly when they lived, when they died, and what they accomplished. And now the question is, where are the Jewish people? And the answer is, we created Wikipedia. We are the ones who write these entries for them. We put them in. We tell them when they're born, when they died. We edit it. We put in the pictures. We write comments. We argue about it. We created Wikipedia. How did that happen? How did that come about? Vespasian could have never imagined this. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did. Four words. Tenli Yavna v'chachameha. He knew that as long as the Jewish people will be able to hold on to Torah, will be able to hold on to its mitzvahs, will be able to have the ark with the poles that will transport the Torah wherever they go, no might will ultimately be able to defeat them or crush them. And therefore, when he's about to die, he asks to make space for who? Chizkiah Melech Yehuda. Ezekiah, the king of Judea. Why Ezekiah? Why Chizkiah? Why not Abraham, Isaac, Jacob? Why not Moses? Why not Hillel? Why not King David? Why Chizkiah? The answer, of course, is Chizkiah was the king of Jerusalem. It was also besieged by Sancheriv. Chizkiah ultimately saved the siege. Sancheriv and his 180,000 troops died. Chizkiah was saved with the entire region. 10 tribes in the north were exiled, but he and the 2 tribes in Jerusalem were saved. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was doubting that he saved Jerusalem, or is he the one who ultimately surrendered Jerusalem to the enemy? Who came to escort him on his final chapter? Who came to bid farewell, to welcome Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to the next world? The man who saved Jerusalem. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did not save Jerusalem. But Chizkiah said, you did save Jerusalem. By asking for Yavna v'chachameha, you kept Jerusalem alive in memory. You kept Jerusalem alive in words. You kept Jerusalem alive in hearts. You kept Jerusalem alive in books. You kept Jerusalem alive in prayers, in texts, in rituals, in traditions. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is the one who instituted that we should shake lulav on Sukkot 7 days. We never did. We used to shake lulav only the first day of Sukkot. There's no mitzvah to shake lulav 7 days. Only the first day. In the Beis HaMikdash there's a mitzvah 7 days. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said we should shake lulav 7 days. Why? Zecher l'mikdash. Keep the Beis HaMikdash alive. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made sure that it lives in the hearts, in the words, in the emotions. 2,000 years later, I was once giving a shir, a lecture. So a very interesting conversation came up. This is a whole other creature. I'm not going to get into it in detail, but I want to bring out one point. And somebody said, you know, the fact is that Israel, the state of Israel, was built by secular Jews, by atheists, not by religious Jews. He says, that's the fact. I said, yeah, but I want to ask you one question. You think it would have been possible for Herzl or Ben Gurion or Moshe Sharet or Chaim Weizmann, or Zalman Shazar, or Sokolov, to even remember and speak about Israel, if not for the Rambam and the Ravid in the 11th and 12th century, arguing in Hilchas Beis Abchira, if you could bring Karbonis today without a Beis HaMikdash, if you have an altar? You think anybody would have thought about Eretz Yisrael if the Kesef Mishnah and the Lechem Mishnah and the Magid Mishnah would not delve into the halachas of Trumas and Maisris and Maisirishin and Maisir Sheini and Maisir Oni and the Kedusha of Yerushalayim and the Kedusha of the Mechitzas and where it could be eaten and where it cannot be eaten? You think anybody would remember Eretz Yisrael and be able to come back if not for Rabbi Akiva Eger and the Beis Halevi and Rabbi Chaim Halevi delving into nights and nights spending, analyzing the definition, the halachas of the Karbonis and the Kedushas of Eretz, and the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, etc. The Jews who sat by candles late at night for 2,000 years and learned the halachas of Karbonas, halachas of Tumah and Tara, halachas of the Beis HaMikdash, halachas of the Azara, halachas of Yom Kippur, halachas of the Kabr Musaf. They kept the country alive. The Jews who stood up three times a day and faced Yerushalayim to daven there. It's the only reason there was a place that was so alive in Jewish memory, Jews could come back there. Jews could come back there. So kol ha'mis'abel al Yerushalayim, zoicha v'roya b'simchasa. I'm going to conclude with this story. The rabbi of Migdal HaEmek in Israel is a Jew by the name of Rabbi Yitzchak David Grossman. Rabbi Yitzchak David Grossman is a very well-known rabbi. He created institutions for Russian children and other children with different challenges, thousands of children in his educational institutions in Migdal HaEmek. A man once came to visit him a few years ago, a guy by the name of Moti Dotan. Moti Dotan is the head of the Lower Galilee Regional Council in Israel. Dotan tells Rabbi Grossman, he says, recently he returned from Germany. He attended a ceremony in honor of the 25th anniversary of the Twin Cities Pact between the Regional Council in the Lower Galilee and the Hanover District in Germany. They had a Twin Cities Pact, 25th anniversary. Moti Dotan traveled to Germany for the celebration. After the ceremony, a German parliament member comes over to the Israeli Moti Dotan, a German Bundestag parliament member. His name is Detlev Herzig. Detlev Herzig is from the SPD party in the parliament. He approaches Moti Dotan and he says, I have to tell you a story. My father, Mr. Detlev Herzig says, died a few weeks ago. Right before his demise, he called me in and he said, I have to make a confession to you. I took part in the atrocities of the Holocaust. Since there are many Holocaust deniers today, he tells his son, I wanted to share the truth before I die so that at least you could tell people that the Holocaust deniers are true liars. He told his son that he had been an officer in the German Air Force, in the Luftwaffe, during World War II, and he hands his son an envelope. His son opens the envelope. Detlev Herzig opens the envelope, and he finds a Wehrmacht Army officer certificate. He was an officer in Hitler's army, in the Wehrmacht. It was wrapped, the certificate was wrapped in a strange wallet. Wonderful, rich, aristocratic feel. It was like a wallet made of expensive parchment. His father says, let me tell you the story behind this wallet. Once, I was with my Nazi comrades, and we went to destroy and burn down a synagogue. On the floor, we threw out a large scroll, and we unrolled it. And it was there on the floor, open from cover to cover. It was huge. And I touched it, and I felt that it's really high-quality parchment. So the Nazi officer cut out a piece of the scroll to use as a wallet. And that wallet he used to place within it his officer certificate. Later, he discovered that this parchment came from something that was very precious to the Jews. It was their Sefer Torah, their Torah scroll. So he tells his son, I want you to give over this envelope to the first Jew that you're going to meet and ask him to deliver it to the holiest Jew in Israel. And he will already know how to use it properly. So, Moti Dotan takes the wallet from Detlev Herzig, who just got it from his father a few weeks ago, comes back to the Holy Land, goes into Rabbi Yitzchak David Grossman, he says, as far as I'm concerned, you're the holiest man in this country. Here is the wallet. Rabbi Grossman takes the wallet in his hand. There it was, made of the cloth, made of the parchment of a Torah scroll of a Sefer Torah. The Nazi officer fashioned a very nice wallet for himself. He was trembling. He was gripped with emotion. Rabbi Yitzchak David Grossman noticed that the Nazi cut out a piece of Torah, not from the empty parchment, from the gvil, but from a part that had in it letters, words. He realized it was from the book of Deuteronomy, the end of Parshas Kisavai, the beginning of Parshas Nitzavim. Rabbi Grossman begins to read the words inscribed in ink on the parchment of this Nazi wallet. They were the terrifying words of the Teichicha, the chapter of rebuke in Deuteronomy at the end of Kisavai, in which the Torah warns of the terrible consequences of the Jews abandoning their covenant with God. And then on the wallet, the Torah continues to say, Atem Nitzavim Hayoim Kulchem Lifnei Hashem Elokeichem. You are standing today before your God. Rabbi Grossman turns to Moti and he says, and now let me show you the Rashi. The Rashi on this verse. Anybody has a Chumash here? Do you have some Chumash? I want to read to you the Rashi. Just a Chumash Dvarim. One of the blue Chumashim on this. Thank you. He reads to Mati what, thank you. He reads to Mati what Rashi says on this verse. Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kolchem, Zokt Rashi. When the Jews heard about all of these words of rebuke, their faces became green, and they said, we're never going to survive. So Moshe began to appease them, and he said, Atem nitzavim hayoim, atem kayamim lefonav hayoim, kayoim hazeh shehu kayam. You are standing in front of him today, like this day, that will always endure. V'hu mafil, even when it gets dark, umeir, sunrise happens once again. Don't think you will ever fade away. You are like the day, like sunlight. It may set, but the sun will yet rise again. That's why Moshe says after the rebuke, Atem nitzavim, hayoim kolchem lefnei Hashem alekechem. So now imagine the scene, my friends. Germans come into a synagogue. They burn it. They murder all of its Jews. They desecrate the Torah scrolls. This was their routine in hundreds of shtetlach, of cities, where they conquer, they entered. One of them has the chutzpah to cut off a piece and use it for his personal wallet. At last, if anybody was standing there, one would say with certainty, Hitler triumphed over the Jews. Hitler triumphed over the Torah. Hitler triumphed over the Jewish God. That was his ambition. As he once said, we have to get rid of the Jewish God and his life-denying Ten Commandments. 6 decades pass. Not so long. 6 decades pass. The wallet ends up in the hands of a rabbi in Israel, in Migdal HaEmek, who has thousands of Jewish children studying from that very Torah that was desecrated in that particular shul. He now kisses the holy parchment and he quotes to the man who brought the wallet from Germany the divine promise that the Jewish people will never perish. Thus, in retrospect, in hindsight, we could look at Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and say to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, thank you, by giving us Yavne v'chachameha, you secured the eternity of the Jewish people and the knowledge that just as the sun set, it will rise again speedily in our days. Thank you. Thank you.
This class is brought to you by the yeshiva.net. Please help us continue the classes. Make even a small contribution at www.theyeshiva.net/donate.